Hello, Susana Lopez here, actor turned barrister turned broadcaster turned true crime writer and proud member of Sisters in Crime Australia. Welcome to the Scarlet Stiletto Bites podcast. For over 30 years now, Sisters in Crime Australia has supported our women crime writers, both true crime and fiction, and some criminal literary talent has been unearthed. Among many awards, there's an annual prize for short crime fiction, the Scarlet Stiletto Awards. And for those of you who prefer your stories by ear, in 2023 we commenced this podcast series, Scarlet Stiletto Bites, to celebrate the sisters' 30th anniversary. Each story is short, but not always sweet. Expect twisted tales, quirky humour, and a frisson of feminism. Please support us by following, sharing, reviewing, and generally spreading the word. We have no paywall. With all the scams and corruption and youth crime and gang activity we hear about, just how suspicious should we be? Especially of someone more senior than ourselves. Today's story dives in. Operation Blue Water by Inga Simpson. Scarlet Stiletto third prize and for Police Procedural 2006. I sat hunched over my screen, squinting at the moving coloured tracks. The novelty of Monday morning had already worn off. We'd heard about what everyone got up to on the weekend, consumed the organic apple cake Marilyn had baked for morning tea, and now the week stretched out in front of me, like a railway line to forever. Opposite someone else's screen alarmed. Some boat, somewhere, had crossed into an illegal zone. I blocked out his call to local compliance and tried to focus on my own screen. The only zone where nothing ever happened. Well, that's how it felt anyway after 7.5 months in this job. Morning, Meg. I sat up straight. Mr. Brand? The manager of our office stood before me, all suited up. He sat on the corner of my desk, one leg swinging. His socks matched. What was going on? I watched as he leant in towards me, smiling. How would you like to get out on the water? I grinned. You bet. Navy's running a big operation. Everyone's involved. Customs, immigration, AFP, quarantine, and they need a bunch of fisheries people. I put your name forward. Thought it might be good experience for you. You'll be at sea 5 to 7 days next week. Whatever plans you had, cancel them. I nodded, too excited to think of anything intelligent to say. Briefings at 1400, conference room. Our lunchroom had prime view over Darwin's harbour. I stared out at the sandy line of soil between the cobalt sea and the green tangle of mangroves. Smoke plumes rose up in the distance, the last of the season's burn-off. Across the table, Lars's mobile beeped. I watched him read the message. Come on, Kindred. Where to meet the Yaltala down at the docks? Looks like it's been up to no good again. I stuffed the rest of the sandwich in my mouth and stood up to pull my overalls over my shoulders, conscious of the white letters on my back. No, it wasn't NYPD or FBI, but out there on the water, AFMA Fisheries carried some weight. I followed Lars out to the Hilux. He'd been my supervisor for the last 3 months and I still couldn't figure him out. He had the languid drawl and walk of most long-termers, but I got the sense there was something more going on underneath. He threw the keys over his shoulder. Apparently, I was driving. Heard you're going out on the op. He made it sound like an accusation. I nodded, watching the road. Ah, you graduates don't know what an easy ride you get. I had to wait years to get out on a trip like that. Maybe I should get myself one of them floppy hats, he half smiled. What'd you do your PhD on anyway? Oceanography, natural resource management? I felt my cheeks grow hot. The lifespan of the Patagonian toothfish. He laughed his slow chuckle. Well, you couldn't be further from your freaky little mates up here. He looked out the window, nodding his head. The corners of his mouth turned down. Was that a hint of respect? Why didn't you apply for a job down in Tassie or the Antarctic? Be better for that skin of yours. I did, I said, pulling up in the government space right in front of the docks. A prawn trawler was making its way in, its gear folded up above it like an insect's wings. That it? Looks like it. We waited in the ute, aircon running while the boat moored. Lars got out first. I tightened my ponytail and adjusted my cap, squinting into the sun, even behind our special issue tropical shades. Afternoon, Ben. Skipper nodded. Lars. This here's my latest offsider, Meg Kindred. Mind if we come aboard? I smiled, but received no acknowledgement. You get used to it. I felt my body relax as soon as I walked on deck, adjusting to being on the water. We passed tanks of prawns, the first tigers for the season. The cabin was low and pokey. I leaned on the doorframe while Lars checked the logbooks. VMS picked you up outside the seasonal zone. All the prawn trawlers were fitted with a tracking device, the vehicle monitoring system, allowing us to gather data as well as monitor compliance with the various zones. I tried to look relaxed, staring at the screensaver on the laptop. The logo of a footy team from down south. The Saints, I figured, from the colours. Meg, do you want to do a quick check of the equipment? So I was Meg in front of people. Was he going to have a man-to-man chat with him about the incursion? I hurried around the boat, checking the booms, nets and lines. Nothing out of the ordinary, apart from beginning to smell like prawn guts. I slid down the rails of the ladder and back to the cabin. As I ducked into the doorway, I saw Lars take something from Ben's hand. I kept my eye on that hand as we said our goodbyes. It slipped into his overalls pocket and came out empty. I reckons they weren't just fishing there, just passing through. The books all check out, so that's not enough to get a warrant. We'll follow up on the catch quota after weigh-in and keep an eye on it, though, eh? Fair enough. We sped towards the customs chopper on the horizon. I stood up front, looking through high-powered binoculars. I had to concentrate to keep the smile from my face when I spotted it. A 20-foot timber vessel painted blue-grey. An ice boat. Stupid name for anything in these waters, if you ask me, but it referred to ice chests down below. I could see puffs of diesel smoke and half a dozen crew busy on deck. They were already on the run, making for the invisible line that marked the edge of our fishing zone. I felt our engines pick up through my legs. Surely the boat didn't have a chance of outrunning us. We drew level, keeping a distance of 100 meters. One of the customs guys ordered them to stop over the megaphone. No response. A second message, in Indonesian this time. The crew had disappeared below. The machine gun above me fired a single shot over their bow like some old-fashioned pirate movie. These were modern-day pirates, I reminded myself. Then two shots together, loud echoing cracks. They didn't stop. We were so close to the line now, it was going to be touch and go. Our dinghy was in the water, but they'd have to board while the boat was at full speed. I watched as our guys pulled alongside. The older one, Craig, crouched, connected by a rope to his buddy, ready to try and jump onto the boat. There was a shout, and he was flat on his face. A shot had come from somewhere. The cabin? The dinghy dropped back and we all breathed again. Once Craig signalled, he was okay. I looked up at the machine gun. It stayed silent. They were going to get away. Around the ship, everyone was dark with disappointment, scratching their heads, hands on hips, arms crossed. Some fucker tipped them off, the customs woman said, coming down from the upper deck. They were off before the chopper got anywhere near them. Makes you wonder what they had on board. Shark fin, probably. But who'd do that? I asked. Well, no one from customs, that's for sure, she snapped. Day 3 was looking more promising. My eyes were tired after a night shift, but the time had been worth it to try out the night vision goggles and the infrared scanner. We'd picked up 3 small boats loaded with reef fish and trepang, now being towed back to Darwin. I set my feet apart, grabbed hold of the railing and turned my face from the spray. We were in full pursuit of another ice boat. It was so low in the water with its catch, it didn't have a chance. They just cut the engine and sat down on the deck, cross-legged. There was no resistance as our team boarded. Most of the crew didn't look more than 16. We watched as Craig held up 2 huge shark fins, still bloody. I felt sick. Whatever you thought of sharks, the idea of them being thrown back alive, swimming around in circles until they drowned or were eaten by some other predator, made me hate humans. Mal tooted as he drove off. At least I'd made one friend from customs. I lifted my arm in a tired wave, smiling with the satisfaction of the best week's work I could remember. Maybe I could get used to living up here after all. The letterbox was full of junk mail, despite the sign asking for none. There were 2 damp letters, one for the previous residents and one for me with the government logo, Environment and Heritage. I slipped them into my pocket, binned the rest, and started up the pastel stairs of the Sands apartment complex. The locals disparagingly referred to it as the Blands, which was about right. I slid a beer into a stubby holder and opened up the doors to the balcony. The afternoon sun sparkled on the water, tropical jewels. I gulped down a few mouthfuls and ripped open my letter. I'd applied for a policy job with the Antarctic Division months ago. About time they sent me the rejection notice. I nearly lost my grip on my beer as I read. I had till Monday to accept the job. Lars leaned on the partition above my desk. Want to sit in on the interviews with the crew of that boat you brought in? Sure. I grabbed my notebook and pen and hurried after him. It was a short drive back to the naval base, and we waited at the boom gate while the uniforms checked us out, then drove on to park in the thin line of shade by the reception building. There was a book to sign, passes to clip on, and we were inside. It was cool in the interview room. I set up the triple-deck tape recorder while we waited. A young immigration officer brought in the first of the crew, small in loose-fitting pants and thongs. The skin on his cheeks was dark and tough from sun and salt. I wrote the date and time at the top of the interview form. Lars explained the process, started recording and began with the basics. What's your name? Ramelan. Identification? He shook his head. But you're master of the ship, captain? He shrugged as if he didn't understand. Lars said something in Indonesian. Now he shook his head vigorously. No, no, not skipper. Oh, come off it. You had the GPS in your pants, mate. Now Lars pulled out the tracking charts, showing the boat crossing into our waters. He tapped his thick fingers on the spot. You were inside the Australian fishing zone. Do you have an Australian fishing licence? Again, Rumilan shrugged and looked down at the floor. Lars tapped the charts again, harder this time, so that the table shook. You were fishing illegally. 40 tons of shark fin. Do you understand that you will be charged? Locked up? If you tell us who owns the boat, it will go better for you. No response. Lars ended the interview and stopped the tapes. Again, he spoke in Indonesian, lots of repeating and rhyming sounds. Whatever he said got Rumilan's attention. He was looking right at us now and starting to sweat. Lars waited, letting the silence draw him out. I watched the second hand of the clock on the wall move around for the third time. Then two short sentences in Indonesian. Lars' face registered no expression, but I saw something in his eyes I didn't like. Anger? I turned up the aircon and wound down my window to let the hot air out. Lars shifted his cap off his forehead. See what I mean? 8 interviews and not one bit of useful information. You speak Indo, I said. He smiled. Secret weapon. Lived up there for a while, when I was younger and dumber. And what happens to them now? The crew will be deported and flown back home. Captain will get a fine. We'll send him down to Baxter till he's charged. Boat'll be scuppered. He sighed as we turned into the office car park. And there's thousands more out there, just like it. Well, what would you do? Well, you gotta wonder. All the money we spend on compliance, maybe it'd be better spent on aid. I stared at him. You see it as a poverty problem? Hell yeah. There's no traditional fishing anymore. The people on these boats are desperate, just trying to support their families. He locked the ute. The boat owners? Now that's a different story. I crunched on an apple as I typed, tapping my foot to the radio. It was almost time to head home for the day and make a decision about that job, I prodded myself. Lars appeared over the partition. I'm just taking a quick run back to the Coonawarra. Some intel came in that I want to try and use on our friend, the captain, before they fly him out tomorrow. He looked down at my screen. Oh, might be better if you keep working on the report. Won't be long. I watched his back, a red manila folder sticking out from under his arm, till he slipped round the corner. Why was I being excluded? The report was nearly finished. And why wasn't he taking the triple deck? I walked past the media, setting up a circus in the car park. Instead of the usual slow and easy chatter around the coffee machine, more people than I'd ever seen here at one time were rushing around with files and phones rang all around the office. Lars was nowhere to be seen. Mr. Brandt's door was closed. Was I the only one who didn't know what had happened? I turned on my PC, left it to warm up and headed to the water fountain. On the way back, I stopped at the assistant's desk. Carol barely looked up from the screen as she typed. Lars was looking for you before. Well, what's happened? Her penciled eyebrows shot up into a leathery forehead. Don't you listen to the news, love? One of the foreign fishermen hung himself overnight. They turned up to take him to the airport and he was dead. Oh, it's hitting the fan everywhere. Shit. My head started buzzing. Which one? I rushed back to my desk and logged on. The emails came dropping in. Too slow. There was an announcement about not speaking to the press unless authorised. No names, no details, no other reference to the death. The media websites were all over it, even the NT News. Human rights advocates were dragging up past events and making the inevitable links to Aboriginal deaths in custody. After all the progress on illegal fishing, the funding we'd fought for, this was a disaster. I scanned every article. The Herald had managed to find out the name of the boat. It was Ramelan's. I stared out at the oil rig squatting in the harbour, sucking the life out of the ocean bed and spewing out waste like an alien parasite. My head was light with turning images of Lars putting his hand in his pocket at the marina that morning. The bits and pieces in Indonesian I hadn't understood. The second visit, the tip-offs the boats were getting. I heard raised voices and, with everyone else, craned my neck to stare as Brandt's office door flung open. Lars stormed out, red in the face. He didn't look at me as he passed, and before I could say anything, he was gone. I stood up to follow him, but found Mr. Brandt between me and the door. "Can I speak with you in my office, Meg?" "Coffee?" he offered. "No, thanks." I sat in the too comfy chair opposite him. "I'm sure you've figured out by now that your Indonesian captain has turned up dead this morning. There's an investigation underway. Obviously the AFP and the coroner are looking into it. So I expect you to keep this to yourself." He paused. Was it a question? Of course. He twirled a fat pen in his left hand. "I'd like to ask you a few questions about the Ramelan interview." "Great." I tried to relax into the chair, but it was swallowing me up. I nodded. "You took notes?" "Yes." "I've listened to the tape. We're waiting on the transcription." He smiled and gave me a direct look that started to draw sweat. "Was there anything that wasn't recorded?" I waited until I had each of my words chosen. "Ramelan answered one of the questions after the tape was turned off." I didn't understand him. "You don't speak Bahasa?" He watched me shake my head. "Ha, it's okay, me neither." Darwin wasn't the easiest place to follow someone. Too many open spaces and not enough people. I'd tailed Lars down to the ski club, but wasn't about to follow him in there on my own. It was just a bunch of once white plastic chairs and tables on the lawn, like a mate's picnic. You couldn't exactly blend into the crowd. I needed a drinking buddy. I slid down into my seat to make the call. "Sarah? Feel like a beer? I found myself down at the club and you know what they say about drinking alone." "Excellent idea. See you in 10. I watched Lars through my binoculars while I waited. He was sitting with a man I didn't know who'd seen too much sun and had tattoos on his forearms. I got out of the car and wandered towards the bar as soon as I saw Sarah's Cortina rumble over the hill. Beers in hand, I chose a table over the other side from Lars, putting his back to me. Sarah raised her Melbourne bitter. "How's this for a view?" I looked out at the sun setting over the water, the play of colour on the clouds shifting above us. "Anywhere else in the world you'd be paying $10 a drink to sit here." "Yeah, and you wouldn't get a little esky to put it in." She turned her grimy polystyrene stubby holder around to show me. It had cigarette burns in the shape of a smiley face. Lars got up while we laughed, shook hands with the guy and headed out. "So, Meglet, what are you going to do about the job at the other end of the world?" "Not sure. It's a bit more money and would build on my research. Probably a good step career-wise. My fish is so topical at the moment. But you wouldn't get to go out hunting for illegal fishermen, would you? And tell me you wouldn't miss this." I looked over her outstretched arms to the tattooed man. He'd been joined by a younger man with hair so short and back so straight he had to be military. I watched as he drank from his beer, looked out to sea and took the yellow envelope that slid across the table. Sarah turned round to see what I was looking at. "Hello, since when have you been into Navy, boys?" I was at work before anyone else, except Carol. No one got in before her. She probably slept here. The secure drive was organised by user and project. I accessed Lars's folders, searching for anything that might give me a clue. People were just starting to arrive when I found it. A minute to Canberra, covering an intelligence report that suggested someone from our office was providing information to boat owners about the patrols in exchange for drugs brought in from Thailand through Indonesia. It was dated the day Ramalan died. Why didn't he go through Brand? My chest felt tight. I shut the document down before anyone could walk past. By the time federal agents Green and Lawler arrived to interview me, I was calm again. They were young and polite, also stupid. When they asked me what time we conducted the interview, they checked off my answer against the logbook. I had only to read a few lines down to see Lars's name again, arriving 1600, departing 1700. Well, there was another name after his, William Brand, 1745. I waited until my corner was clear before logging onto the database. A search for Ramalan brought up three hits. We'd picked him up before, in 2003 and 2004. He'd been let off and flown home in both cases. There wasn't enough detail recorded to properly explain why. Probably he hadn't been captain then, just a crew member. I tabbed down to the case officer, Lars Sorensen. It was the last night to make a decision. I went for a run up the beach, despite the gauge telling me humidity was at 86%. At the cliffs I stopped and stared out at the sun melting into the shallow Arafura that separated us from our neighbours to the north. Once there'd been a lot of traffic between us, in boats far more flimsy than the ones we hauled in. Traditional fishing rights now superseded by border control, legislation and bureaucracy. A group of Aboriginal boys on bikes sped past me on the footbridge, laughing and swearing. I cut through the streets to pick up a few things from the shops, checking out the homes on the way. It was almost dark now, the lights inside glowing magically orange among the foliage. One day, I'd live in a house. It started to rain, large drops far apart that soaked into my singlet. I stopped. Lars' Jeep was parked on the street. What was he doing here? Around the corner, I thought I saw someone duck under a sail that served as a carport in front of a rambling old weatherboard. I crouched in the shadows, wishing for the cover of a hedge or something more dense than the gingers and old mango between me and the house. The rain was coming down heavily now. I felt movement behind me as a big hand clamped down on my shoulder. I froze, the wet night turning white in front of me in my panic. Looking for someone? I turned to face Lars, smiling in the dark. Come on, Kindred. We need to get in a bit closer if we're going to see anything. We peered through a dirty window into a cluttered studio under the house with a single bed in the corner. Four men were sitting around an old wooden table. One of them was a middle-aged Indonesian smoking a hand-rolled cigarette. There was the young Navy guy from the club and an old fishing boat owner that I recognised from the wharves. And Brand, sucking on a tin of Foster's and counting neat piles of $100 notes. Lars nodded at me, encouraging me to believe it. His eyes were bright, too bright, as if he hadn't slept for days. Lars held a camera up to the window. I held my breath while he took the shots and tried to catch the conversation inside. The rain on the tin roof above us drowned out everything but Brant's familiar deep voice. I've taken care of that. He's on leave until they complete the investigation. The tone from the Indonesian was angry, Relax, he won't be back. Brant slapped his hands on the table. I've made sure of it. Lars's greying hair was flat on his head and dripping down his face. He gestured that we should move away. We stayed low until we were out on the street and ran for his jeep. What the hell's going on? Well, what do you reckon? You've been following me around. I tried to put it in a logical order while he started the engine and moved off towards Casuarina Drive. Brant has been giving information to fishing boat owners. Ramelan was one of his contacts. He'd been picked up twice before and let off. The young officer from the base is in on it, but his older Navy buddy from the ski club, a friend of yours, has been playing it both ways and tipped you off. When Brant realised you'd figured it out, he paid Ramelan a visit. Next thing, he's dead. And now he's trying to set you up, make it look like you're the one who's bent. I stopped, trying to read his face. But I'm not sure how he got the guy to kill himself. He nodded, a smile shifting his jaw back and down. Me either. If he did. He pulled up outside my apartment block. Close, kiddo. Very close. For the rest, I need a drink and something to eat. Are you going to invite me in? I opened beers while Lars phoned for Chinese. Your surveillance techniques could use some work, he said. Well, why didn't you say something? I figured it couldn't hurt to have some backup. He sculled the rest of his beer. I got him another and waited. Brand asked you about the interview? I nodded. And your second visit. He was worried by your Bahasa conversation. And so was I. I thought it was you on the take. Thought so. I pushed my empty bottle around in wet circles on the glass top table. You didn't think it was worth clearing up? He shrugged. It was better you didn't know anything. I waited for the rest. Ramelan works for us. That's why we let him go last time. It's dodgy. He still does what he does, but we get the information we need. He made it clear that we should look inside. Told me to check his phone. I had a mate from the AFP do a check and he found Brant's mobile number. I went back to try and get more information from Ramelan about who the big bosses were. Someone must have tipped Brant off and he panicked. I tried to take it all in. What happened when he went down there? I can only imagine. Maybe threatened his family or told him he'd be locked up in a detention centre indefinitely. We'll have to see if the inquest turns anything up. But he's going to try and pin it on you. I got up to answer the door. Our food was here. We've got to do something. I intend to. The tone of my second interview was far more friendly. Lars had tried to keep me out of it, but I knew it all had a better chance of sticking if he had a witness to back him up. Federal Agent Green pushed over the photos Lars had taken. Have you seen any of these men before? I was there when this was taken. I explained the context and my other sighting of the naval officer. Did you hear anything that was said? Mr. Brant made it clear that he was going to make sure it looked like Lars, Mr. Sorensen, was the last one to see Ramelan alive. And corrupt. You'd be willing to testify at the hearing? I watched the tapes whirring round. In the list of career-limiting moves, this had to be in the top three. Yes. I walked out past Brant's office. Two more AFP officers were packing up his hard drive. It was not yet four, but I figured my work day was over. Lars was waiting at the bar. I ordered us two beers and slid onto the stool next to him. How'd it go? I raised my bottle. I said I'd testify. Cheers to the two snitches. To corruption caught out, I corrected. It's gonna be ugly. Must go deeper than Brandt. He drank from his beer, a fleck of foam sticking in the corner of his mouth. We watched a group of middle-aged women out on the deck who, judging by their volume, had been here all afternoon. The one at the head of the table lurched forward, holding up her glass. I looked at the soggy strawberry inside, bleached pale by too many champagnes. Next time I leave, I don't think I'm coming back. I really have to get out, she announced to her audience. They nodded as if they understood. There was one question left unanswered. What about down at the marina? What about it? I saw you take money from Ben. He grinned. Been doing it for years. I tried to keep the shock from my face. It's his own fault. He keeps backing that useless team of his. Ah, footy bets. Sorry, I thought, don't worry about it. Usually it pays to be suspicious. Flames took hold of the rotten timber and smoke swirled out above us, stinking of diesel fuel. They'd flown in the minister to make a show of lighting the boats like some sort of festival, as if we didn't have enough of those up here. There were cheers and clapping from the crowd gathered on the wharf. Did we really have the right to burn their property for trying to survive? But our fish stocks and natural habitats have to survive too, I told myself. The boats carried all the quarantine nasties, lice, rats, and that rampant striped mussel. They were all ablaze now, the heat pushing us a shuffling step back. Embers split off, hissing into the water. Cameras whirred and beeped, capturing the occasion. For me, it marked the end of my time in the Territory. Oh, I'd be back for the inquest, but my life in the field was over for now. I began the long walk back up to town. It would be hours till the boats burned away, leaving a few twisted scraps of metal behind for salvage. The end. Thanks so much for listening. We'd love to get your feedback and we'd love to reach more listeners. Our website is sistersincrime.org.au and our email address is admin@sistersincrime.org.au. Until next Friday then, when we bring you another scintillating story from Australian women crime creators.